details at mariner-usa.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Growth is inevitable in a city like Charlotte. People come here because of the city's amenities and because it's an attractive, manageable place to live. But as we grow, so do the challenges associated with maintaining the qualities that make us attractive. As anyone who has lived here a while can tell you, growth is changing Charlotte, sometimes for the better, sometimes not. And it isn't just the downtown core that is being remade. Some very established neighborhoods are being transformed as well, allowing new growth in those neighborhoods while not irrevocably altering the character of those areas is a big challenge, but it can be done, at least according to our guests today. Tom Lowe is an architect and director of Charlotte Civic by Design, whose purpose is to elevate the quality of our region's built environment and to promote public participation in the creation of a more beautiful and functional region for all. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us is Michael Poe, Ph.D., Senior Research Manager with the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Preservation Green Lab in Seattle, Washington. In that capacity, he assesses the contributions to communities made by existing buildings and commercial districts. Michael, thank you for joining so early in the morning for Seattle.
Pleased to be here, Mike. Thanks.
And Tom Lowe, by the way, is conducting a Civic by Design forum tonight at 5:30 at the Levine Museum of the New South. We have information about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Before we talk about growing from this point forward and what we have to do to protect what we already have as we go forward, let's talk about how we've handled growth so far in Charlotte. We have a significant number of mammoth mid-rise apartments that are coming up like flowers in the springtime up and down South Boulevard and elsewhere as well. We have development in the center city. We've seen a decent amount of teardowns and infill houses going in established neighborhoods. Tom, you live here. You've been observing this. You're working toward keeping things on an even keel. How have we handled it so far?
Well, it really is exciting to see all this activity. It seems like every street corner in the center city, there's a new, three, four, five, six-story development happening. And it's going up quickly. And I think that's created a lot of the anxiety. Change is happening very quickly. It's different. And people are excited, but I think they're alarmed, too, because things they love may be, being threatened or actually being replaced. And I think that's one of the things that has created a lot of concern. Actually surprised how much concern I wasn't aware of until I started looking into it a little bit.
Yeah, but isn't change inevitable? And isn't the loss of things you love, because I love certain things that you may not love, isn't that also inevitable?
Absolutely, it is inevitable, and I think it's just a matter of making it, making change work and the transition in a way that, is the most beneficial. And you have to look at short-term things and also long-term aspects, too, and that's what's key.
You work for the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Preservation Green Lab, Michael Poe. What is a Preservation Green Lab?
Good question. Preservation Green Lab is sort of like the research and development arm of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which sort of, has a little tension in the terms right there, right? Historic preservation, backward-looking research and development. We're interested in the new tools and sort of making these new arguments, oftentimes market-based arguments for building reuse, not just environmental, but in terms of the social and economic value of these places as well.
And we're going to talk about that as we go through the program, because you've done a lot of research into this and are an advocate for keeping older, smaller buildings because of their economic impact on a region. Most people look at those buildings and say, well, let's get rid of them. They've lived their time. It's time to move on. But you say, hold on. We'll talk about that. We recently did a program that involved development in places in Charlotte like Plaza Midwood and NoDa and other long-established areas whose funkiness, if you'll pardon the expression, is part of what attracts people there, but what could also be easily erased by development. Aren't there some areas that should be considered good places to simply start over, or do all areas have things about them that should be preserved? Let's get the 30,000-foot view first from Michael, who doesn't live here.
Well, I mean, of course, places are going to change, and they should. You know, I think our work shows that older, smaller buildings certainly matter, but something magical happens when there's new development alongside the old. And in places that have, you know, great old bones, great older, smaller buildings and commercial blocks, where you have new buildings that fit alongside those, you actually see, you know, greater nightlife, statistically speaking. Some surprising things. So people really want to spend their time not just for their old buildings, but where there's a mix of old and new. And I think we just need to be smart about how we sort of manage that process.
You know, if you talk about nightlife in Charlotte, if you come down here on College Street on any night of the week, except maybe Monday, most of it is centered around bars and clubs that are in very old buildings. But what about the neighborhoods around Charlotte, where some development is taking place, like in Plaza Midwood, for instance, Tom, where people are bemoaning the potential loss of old neighborhood landmarks? How do you know when something's outlived its usefulness?
Well, I think clearly these older neighborhoods are flourishing. Mm-hmm.
For a reason.
Yeah. They're wonderful. They have a high quality, you know, great quality of life, mm-hmm. and people realize that. And they're in demand, and I think that's what's key. The housing stock has been, you know, brought back considerably, and there's a lot of attention. People are really embellishing and taking care of these homes and fixing them up, and at the same time, the commercial corridors, the old neighborhood main streets, are starting to transition also. Mm-hmm. And that's where you see, say, some of these kind of old farm-to-market roads that are now commercial corridors that maybe were more, you know, shopping centers, but also nice little buildings, nice little structures. Those are the ones that tend to be the kind of the first place where higher density development happens. Mm-hmm. And so that's one particular, you know, there are some particular cases where you see a lot of the kind of large multifamily projects that are popping up.
Michael, you recently completed work on the Preservation Green Lab's Older, Smaller, Better project, which demonstrated the critical role that older buildings play in supporting social, cultural, and economic vitality of urban neighborhoods. Did that come as a surprise to you, or did this study simply solidify the things that you'd already witnessed taking place here and around the country?
You know, I'm sort of one of the converted in the preservation world. I would not have considered myself a preservationist. Actually, before conducting this study, I was brought onto the Green Lab team for that project. But during this work, you know, especially finding things that like the relationship between older, smaller buildings and sort of a strong local economy, neighborhood economy, I think building reuse is inequality mitigating versus tearing things down, building large, sort of out of place, large developments. Oftentimes that comes from developers outside of the city, from banks outside of the city. And so it doesn't really benefit local communities. So, you know, one of the things we found in this report that I think was just stunning was more than twice the rate of women and minority ownership of businesses where you have older, smaller buildings compared to where you have areas that are predominantly new buildings.
And why is that?
You know, it actually makes a lot of sense when you start to really dig into it. So new buildings, oftentimes, you know, they'll have financing, new financing from a bank. And so as part of that, they'll require long leases, long lines of credit, things that local businesses can't necessarily compete with and sign up for. So that's why new buildings are more likely to see, you know, Quiznos than, you know, local sandwich shop.
Hmm. So that's one of the reasons you say that older, smaller buildings have a role to play not only in the character of a neighborhood, but in the economic vitality of a neighborhood. Talk about that a little bit more, because I think people look at these older, smaller buildings that were built in the 30s and 40s and maybe in the 50s and say, you know, life was very different back then. Those buildings are not wired the way they're wired today for a digital world, etc. So maybe it's time to get rid of those and put something new and bigger, because everything in the world is bigger today than it used to be. Talk about why this is so valuable to keep.
Yeah, well, we certainly have a fascination with the new. We found, you know, things actually where you have older, smaller buildings, you see greater concentrations of jobs and creative industries. You see greater concentrations per square foot of jobs and of businesses in general. So, you know, the skyscrapers downtown certainly have an important place, and large buildings in general certainly have an important place in an economy. But you get a different kind of character. You get a lot of these entrepreneurial startups in these small buildings. And so I think part of it's the question of, you know, what's the right balance to strike there? You know, you certainly want to have Bank of America in Charlotte, of course, you know, and you want to obviously create space for that. But you also want to grow the next Bank of America. Or in Seattle, use our examples, you know, Boeing and Microsoft and Starbucks. All three, actually, if you dig up their original photographs of their original locations, they're pretty crummy old buildings. So part of it's just wanting to sort of develop something, the next big thing. And then part of it's that these small structures support, you know, walkable, bikeable, connected communities. We certainly see the millennial population, people between the ages of 18 and 34, roughly, moving to these areas. We see a significantly younger residents where you have older, smaller buildings, which as a fairly young person surprised me. I didn't necessarily think that would come out that way. And you actually also see a greater mix of young and old residents. The American Planning Association last year conducted this national survey and found that boomers and millennials, the two largest generations in American history, both expressed a clear preference in this survey for walkable environments. And we think the best walkable environment is the place that sprung out of the ground before cars were such a ubiquitous, commonplace thing in cities. So, of course, we need to hang on to some of this stuff while welcoming new dense development.
I would guess that the fact that these two generations, the boomers and the millennials, which make up so many people who are now expressing a desire for walkable communities after years of building America as one big suburb, where you have to get from one place to the other by car as opposed to by foot, I would think that's what's driving this change in the suburbs that we're experiencing, the close-in suburbs that we're experiencing in Charlotte, because people are trying to move away from the outlying areas back into the urban core, and that's causing a demand for new housing and more housing in those areas. So how do you balance, Tom, the desire to keep older, smaller buildings with the need for new construction, and how do you decide what older, smaller building stays and what new piece is built? How do you decide? How do you make the decision?
Well, it's, I think, what Michael's touching on, and he has a lot of good information about things like how projects are financed. And when you look around at all the new development that's happening, it's different. It has a different character to it, I think that the formulas that are used, the same floor plans, the same elevations, the same, you know, there's kind of a building type. Some people call it the Texas donut because it's a big kind of apartment building in the shape, you know, wraps the block, and you build parking below and add, you know, stick frame housing above. That's something that's different from what we've experienced here in Charlotte. And I think that it's really people are trying to get their arms around what all that means, the scale of this. And it's very difficult with these types of investments to say, let's accommodate this really charming little building as part of that. So we really have to think, I think, you know, one of the things we need to think about is how, say, architects, say, good designers, good urban designers, can sharpen their pencil. And I think one of the things I really want to drive home with this is really we need to boost an appreciation for architecture.
Okay, and we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about these big buildings that have the same elevation that are going up all over town as we go through the program. And when we come back, I want to find out from Michael what cities are doing this particularly well, finding a good way to blend the old with the new. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance journalism excellence in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. Well, this is not the only city in the region attracting business. Matthews is holding its own. They're witnessing a spike in small business owners calling Main Street their Main Street home. Young professionals, retirees, also moving to Matthews because of their affordable cost of living. So just what kinds of entrepreneurs and small business owners are opening up shop there? How has Matthews changed in the recent past? We're going to hear about that from some folks who know the area well tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, antitrust regulators in the U.S. and elsewhere are evaluating Monsanto's recent bid to acquire the world's top seller of crop pesticides. What consolidation in the seed and pesticide industries could mean for farmers and the market power of Monsanto.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Tom Lowe, architect and director of Civic by Design. They are holding a Civic by Design forum tonight at 5:30 at the Levine Museum of the New South. Also with us, Michael Poe, who is a senior research manager for the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Preservation Green Lab. He joins us by phone from Seattle, Washington. Michael, I know that other cities around the country face or have faced the same kind of growth that Charlotte is currently enduring. Where do they seem to be handling this growth particularly well from a standpoint of being able to blend the old and new successfully?
Well, you know, I think it's hard to find places that you could say are really leading the charge or are exemplary in this regard. I think sort of whenever there's this tension, and this oftentimes it's only in negative sort of terms, and how negative are the terms. I think in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, there's an adaptive reuse ordinance that just took certain requirements off the board, off the books, for reusing an existing building so that you don't have to bring that building all the way to the new code and add parking requirements, for instance, if you're reusing a building. So the adaptive reuse ordinance in LA stripped that away and actually led to a crazy transformation of downtown LA, an area that had beautiful historic buildings. Suddenly, over the last 15 years or so, they've added about 14,000 new residents in the area and 60 rehabs. And there are new buildings mixed in with the old. It's sort of all added density. So I think LA is doing it really well. Seattle, I think, you know, Seattleites probably are still asleep right now, so they won't jump on me about this. But the neighborhood where the Green Lab is actually located in Seattle has been changing really radically. And I think the character, some character is being lost. But at the same time, you know, we have things like a density bonus if you reuse part of a building. There's a lot of hand-wringing and uncertainty about whether that's the right approach. But the city's being proactive about it and trying to sort of come up with a solution and trying to tweak their response so that we can keep some of those buildings around and keep some of the businesses. I think in Capitol Hill in Seattle, there's also great local developers that are from the neighborhood and really care about the neighborhood and care about the quality of life there. So I think that's a big part of it as well. You know, that's tough to describe as a best practice. It's tough to really say we need to grow new local developers in the neighborhood. But, you know, I think where you can sort of make that happen, I think you're going to get a better result.
You talked about in the last segment, you talked about how younger people love older buildings. Why? Do you know why? Because, I mean, that's part of your study that you conducted. Is there a reason why they love them? Is it because the rent is less? Is it because it's they're usually located in places that have a lot of different kinds of amenities like coffee shops and restaurants and retail and apartments? What's the reason for it?
Yeah, I think you're hitting on it. I mean, I don't have we didn't do a survey, so I can't actually tell you statistically why young people seem to love old buildings. But I think those two things you just said hit on it. Number one, the low rent associated with old buildings. You know, old buildings are basically a reservoir of naturally affordable space. You know, we talk about affordable housing in cities across the country, especially growing cities. And old buildings are really the sort of naturally, you know, without state subsidy, the affordable space. So yeah, young people are going to live there. But I think your second point, you know, the kinds of neighborhoods where you find these old buildings, you're more likely to see, as I said, these local businesses. You're likely to see non-chain businesses and coffee shops. I think there's also a sort of an environmental argument. If you look at the sort of longer span of history here, You know, over the past couple of decades, we've been more interested in walkability, partially from a public health kind of perspective. People just want to be active. But I think there's also the sustainability argument, you know, and the greenest building is one that already exists. An architect named Carlo Elefante came up with that. And we actually did a whole other study that tested that, found that that's true. So comparing reusing an existing building is oftentimes a smarter sort of climate change response than tearing it down and building even a LEED quality green building. Mm. So there's an environmental piece of this as well.
So the fact that these buildings were not built to be terribly energy efficient, that they sometimes probably leak or are not as well insulated as a modern construction might be, that's offset by the fact that you don't need to tear it down and build something new. That offsets the environmental impact.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And, you know, the things like the windows that are leaking, there are, you know, retrofit options to sort of make the windows much more efficient without sort of tearing the whole building down. Okay. The carbon associated with not, you know, tearing the building down and building something new, certainly. But I think also there's sort of an underappreciated thing about old buildings that they were built to be energy efficient. There wasn't the same amount of energy sort of flowing through buildings, so they had to be more efficient. So you see operable windows, you know, you can open when it's a little cooler outside. You don't see that in new buildings as often. You see sort of high ceilings that sort of have a passive cooling element. So there's actually a lot of sort of wisdom and intelligence in that old design. And actually, when you look at those cities like New York and Philadelphia are doing these benchmarking ordinances where they require large buildings to report their energy consumption. And actually, the old buildings are outperforming the newer buildings, even in that aggregate data in the city.
Yeah. We want to hear from our listeners. What are your ideas on how to help neighborhoods in Charlotte grow while maintaining their character? You can let us know by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE. You've mentioned this term earlier, Tom, and I think so did Michael, but you talk about sterilizing development. That's a new term for me. I think I know what you mean, but I'd never heard it put in those words. So what do you mean by sterilizing?
Well, that's not my term. It's something that came out of people here in Charlotte. And the first time I saw it was a banner that was held up at a city council meeting that said they're concerned about Tommy's Pub in Plaza Midwood. And came out in force and organized, and they held up signs that said, "Don't sterilize Charlotte." And I think that, you know, that kind of hit on a lot of what people's emotions are these days with all the new stuff that's happening and whether change is happening in a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned Tommy's Pub, because in the program we did not too long ago on Plaza Midwood and Noda and Elizabeth, Tommy's Pub came up, and we had a developer working in Plaza Midwood, and we had the head of the Plaza Midwood Neighborhood Association. And the development would take out Tommy's Pub, and you would have thought that the head of the neighborhood association would have been against that, but he wasn't, and he said most of the residents aren't because they don't frequent it. So when you have a situation like Tommy's Pub, which is unique, which is funky to say the least, how do you know whether it stays or go? How goes? How do you know whether that's a good idea to eliminate it or to preserve it? How do you know?
Well, there are a lot of things that can help with that decision. One of the things is it's loved by everyone within that area, and I think you just feel that. I think it is the oldest, you know, kind of hangout.
Uh-huh.
And when people look at the building, some people see it as being, you know, kind of an old passé, you know, building that's, you know, no longer useful. But I see those types of buildings. It's a building type. It's an old shopfront building type. It's very charming. It's very relevant today as a model for how we can grow. And you know that I do a lot of work actually around the country, all over the world, and one of the building types that we constantly are applying is that exact same building type. It's very resilient. It's a building that learns and can be adaptable over time. And I think that the key is just trying to figure out how you can accommodate that and what kind of development, if it's very dense, that you put next to it. Mm-hmm. But again,
when you preserve a place like Tommy's Pub and you do allow development around it, doesn't it stick out like a sore thumb? Does that not all, you've altered the character of the neighborhood surrounding it? Does that become the pimple on the nose of that development?
I think that, again, let's boost an appreciation for architects and architecture. I think that architects can sharpen their pencils. They can be very, very accommodating, sympathetic, and they can complement development.
But are architects in control, or is it the developers who are in control?
Well, that's another good point. Because of the climate right now with financing, it's very formula-driven. It's a very coarse-grained, very large-scale approach, and the materials and all sorts of things are kind of predefined.
Talked about this a little bit the last program. Yeah. We talked about all these apartment buildings going up, and although they're not exactly the same, there is a fundamental sameness about mm-hmm. the elevation of these apartments. And even the developers will sit here and tell you that the floor plans of these apartments are fairly identical. So you might be encouraged to move into it when it's brand new, but in 5 or 10 or 15 years when it isn't brand new anymore and you're looking at all these different apartments that are fundamentally the same inside, what's the incentive to want to rent one of those as opposed to something that will then be new? And the fact that the elevation of these apartments is relatively the same, it is changing the look of the city. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because cities do develop looks over time.
Well, I think every era, kind of developed its own character, and I guess we're inheriting this kind of look.
Well, how would you describe the look?
Well, it's interesting. I did a little research because, I was thinking, similar things. But, it's kind of like this this kind of five Bs came out that I kept reading and hearing, bland, boring, beige, behemoth boxes. And I was just like, well, there you go. And I think if the community is feels that way about it, then we should do something about it. We need to push back a little bit. We need to, again, appreciate good architecture. I think the building arts comes into play here, which you just don't see that kind of quality.
Is there anything governing the style of the architecture? Are there architectural review boards at the city or the county level?
Well, that's a whole other topic, as you know.
There's a bill going through the legislature right now that would essentially neuter any control that local governments may have on, because they won't. The bill, as written, I understand, applies to local design. It controls design adopted prior to the bill, so it goes back in time. So if this bill passes, local governments may no longer be able to apply already adopted design controls to single family and townhome developments anywhere in the state.
Yes, yes, and I think that there's probably a good future show here where you can invite in some of the small towns that are probably going to be affected, and also the difference between kind of the new areas of Charlotte versus the older, smaller neighborhoods of Charlotte. I think it's really defining them as two distinct areas, and unfortunately this bill was set up in reaction to some of the stuff that was happening out in the suburbs. And unfortunately, I think the people that are, they're going to be winners and losers in this. The losers are probably the older, smaller neighborhoods and the small towns.
Michael, when it comes to sterilizing development, I understand, I may be wrong, but I understand that you are less concerned about aesthetics and more concerned about building to last. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I don't wring my hands, really about how it all sort of comes together. Although I recognize your question, if you build these new, if you want to call them the big behemoth beige boxes like Tom does or not. But if you build all these new buildings around Tommy's Pub, for instance, I don't know the structure, but what does that really look like? And at what point is it no longer the character of the neighborhood to have Tommy's Pub? Those are tough questions. How do you know when to save an old building? That's very tough. I think it's sort of when you hear people speak out in support of a building or a business, I think that's the point when it's worth saving.
Hmm.
When
cities change over time, Charlotte does not look anything like it looked. Downtown Charlotte does not look like it looked in 1985. It didn't in 1985 look like it looked in 1950. It certainly didn't look like it looked in 1950 in 1850. So things change over time, and businesses and buildings come and go, and building standards change, and buildings become obsolete. So given the inevitability of all of this, what are we fighting?
Well, I think one of the maps that Michael has provided which is, you know, doing a lot of GIS mapping, shows that everything in the center city inside the inner loop really has been rebuilt. There's very little history left right. in the center city. You see the red dots are kind of the older buildings when you look at the map. There are just a few dots left. But then when you go outside the inner loop, everything.
Two places red. Like Elizabeth, yeah, Myers Park, absolutely. Plaza Midwood.
Every one of them, yeah.
To the west of town, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people are really gravitating towards. So, and of course, we're building we've rebuilt the downtown four times, you know, from the ground up. And that happens in a lot of places. But I think there are examples, I think the inner ring suburbs, the old neighborhoods, are the ones that we can really focus on.
And you, too, are concerned about the sterilized developments, not just because of the sameness, but also, you say, because of weak design and poor construction that will not age well and which will quickly become passé. Mm-hmm. When you say poor construction, what are you talking about?
Well, let me preface that a little bit. When as an architect and you say weak design, it sounds like you're being critical of your peers, and I'm not necessarily. Imagine there's probably some architect listening to this program, sitting in front of his computer, working on the next new apartment building, mm-hmm. Texas Donut, and he's probably pounding his fist and saying, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. You know, our client is forcing us to use these materials. Our client is forcing us to kind of shove it into this mold. It really is financial driven at this point, and where the finance is coming from is a big part of it. And I think we need to figure out a way to do that. Michael has some suggestions, I think, about that in terms of, you know, local financing as a way. We can empower small builders and developers, which we haven't at this point. They're all, you know, kind of these big projects. And I think it's just a matter of taking a stand and really being advocates of what, you know, ways of doing this well.
Well, I was going to ask, does smaller really work in today's economy? Does smaller and better work in today's economy? Because, Michael, you talk about smaller, better. How does that work? If everything has to be big, if economies of scale to make it work, how do you deal with small places?
Well, I think there's sliding notions about what works. And I think there's a certain expectation for the rate of return with development now. And I think that can't necessarily be fulfilled by small development. But there are developers that certainly make this kind of thing work. In fact, one of the women who helped found the Green Lab 6 years ago is a developer herself. And, you know, I think she takes risks in trying to find the right local tenants. She doesn't rent out the chains. But she's building some new stuff and she's reusing some old stuff and she's doing it on a very small scale and the neighborhood loves her for it. She's, she's renowned locally and nationally to some extent.
But if you have a piece of property, like I'm looking across the street now at a parking lot, literally it's a flat parking lot. If I were a developer and wanted to buy that land and put a building on it, I wouldn't put a couple of one-story buildings on it that wrap around the block. I'd put three or four or five or six stories, or maybe even taller because I'm downtown. So I could get my money back out of it. You can make more money on a multi-story building. So why keep smaller when you can get bigger?
Well, let me just say, because I'm looking out the window too, Michael, there is a parking lot that's empty. It's a perfect place for a dense building, and right next to it is an older historic building. And I think the key is that we try to, you know, accommodate the existing building, which right. has been renovated, I think, two or three times. Right. It's a resilient building.
Let me get Michael's comment on that, and when we come back, I have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Michael Poe, Senior Research Manager for the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Preservation Green Lab, and Tom Lowe, an architect and director of Civic by Design. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at diamondsprings.com. Antitrust regulators in the United States and elsewhere are evaluating Monsanto's recent bid to acquire the world's top seller of crop pesticides. What could consolidation in the seed and pesticide industries mean for farmers. On the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, they'll take a look at the market power of Monsanto and more. That's at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And a reminder that the Civic by Design Forum is tonight, 5:30, Levine Museum of the New South. We're coming right back.
Do your part during the California drought and take your car to the car wash?
We're actually only using about 2 to 2.5 gallons per car, and that's less than like a dishwasher uses.
I'm Molly Wood. The surprising upsurge in car washes during a major dry spell. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Lowe, local architect. Michael Poe is senior research manager for the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Preservation Green Lab. Just prior to the break, we were talking about economies of scale. And if you have a parcel of land that's ripe for redevelopment, or you're a landowner with buildings on it and you want to make more money, it seems to me that you would add bigger buildings to it. So how in this economy and in this economic reality do you discourage people from doing that, Michael?
Well, I don't think you want to discourage people from making money. That's not the point, and that's not a winning argument, is it? We were talking about this parking lot across the street and the development opportunity there. I mean, I think, first of all, great to build on a surface parking lot and add something to the neighborhood rather than tearing something down. So add something where there was essentially nothing before. You can always build parking underneath. But I think there's sort of a question about the sort of density. I think you can build tall and narrow. People don't often do that. And I think you'll have greater resilience if you have greater diversity in your sort of portfolio rather than building the same thing all the time and seeing a boom and bust. If you build something that's made to last and that's perhaps a little smaller, but it gives you a base by which to sort of if one thing doesn't work, you can always count on this building. The money may not be as big initially, but I think on a longer time horizon, if we can kind of get past the quick buck, I think you're going to get a better outcome financially and in terms of the impact.
But can we get past the quick buck? I know on some of these shows that we've been doing about development is that the developers come in and they're not in it to make long-term money. They're in it to develop the property and then sell the property.
Right, right. And if they do it, they hit the lottery. And I think that's, you know, the kind of their feeling is that is one way of doing the development. But there is within the industry a growing number, let's just say, of developers and builders which are really interested in taking the long view.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a group on Facebook that people can check out called the Small Developers and Builders. And they're forming a coalition. There are a lot of women developers that are involved with that group, and they're starting to have meetings around the country with an organization called Strong Towns.
Okay.
And so I think that Charlotte needs to kind of look into this and to really investigate. You know, let's attract the developers that make our neighborhoods better.
I want to get back to your newer, smaller, better study, Michael, because better, it seems to me, if you're talking about building better buildings, that better is going to increase your building costs, isn't it?
Well, I think at times that's true, yeah. And I think, you know, retrofitting an old building and making it sort of work like a new building, oftentimes that is more expensive than building new, but the product is so much better and the outcomes can be so much better. You know, the Preservation Green Lab and the National Trust have been working closely with the Urban Land Institute. Actually, ULI, the Urban Land Institute, is a group of developers and land use professionals who I think really are interested in the bottom line. And we've been working in cities like Los Angeles and Philadelphia and Baltimore, working in Chicago and Detroit right now with those developers and bringing preservationists to the table as well and trying to figure out how we can sort of make these things pencil out more readily, make building reuse a more attractive option. And I think that, you know, there are a variety of strategies for approaching that, for sort of keeping character and balancing character and new growth. But I think anytime you can create programs and incentives that just support building reuse and make the bottom line a little you know, not as tough a pill to swallow with building reuse. Things like stripping away, you know, additional parking requirements if you adapt an existing building, or even providing some sort of density bonus, transfer of development rights. I think there are a lot of things that cities are doing now that help developers make these kinds of decisions, you know, help them make the right decision by the neighborhood. So it's not simply just telling people that they can't make as much money. It's we want to actually level the playing field so that building reuse is as attractive an option as tearing down and building something new.
In doing a lot of shows about new urbanism, and I believe you've been on a few of those shows, Tom,
yes.
We've talked about how cities helped encourage the development of suburbs through ordinances and building codes and zoning requirements, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Is that beginning to shift our cities? Is Charlotte beginning to shift and making it easier to do things in denser areas than it used to be?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, the small towns were the early adopters here of new urbanism, which basically have created walkable, connected neighborhoods and mixed-use, mixed-income communities. Charlotte, for a long time, was not interested in that. They were busy building their beltway. And we know that it just finished that.
Took 27 years.
Right, 27 years. And so it's out there, and a lot of people are, I guess, excited and happy about that. But what's happening now is the leading development companies here, along with local elected leaders and officials, have embraced new urbanism wholesale, and like the three huge projects happening out in South Charlotte, Providence Road, 485, are all walkable villages, mixed use, mixed income. They have highly amenitized. Basically, they're set up to attract people that are getting tired of all this, you know, to drive everywhere issues.
Right.
And I think, just to say that, I think that influence, you know, sometimes it starts, you know, on the outside and then works its way in. We have all these older, great neighborhoods that basically are already here that actually provide that already. So let's don't mess them up.
Michael.
Yeah, I was gonna add that. Yeah, so I think new urbanists have come a long way, actually. I think from, you know, in the early days of new urbanism, there were a lot of projects that were built out, you know, in the suburbs or outside of cities, sort of the landmark projects in new urbanism like Seaside in Florida. And I think in more recent years, and even, you know, just in the past few months, there's been incredible interest from the Congress for New Urbanism in infill development and small scale and building on sort of older areas. So I'm really excited by the prospective partnerships between organizations like the National Trust and the Congress for New Urbanism looking forward.
Older buildings can be protected from time to time through getting them landmark status. But, Michael, I believe you suggest that neighborhoods need something along that line, need ordinances that incentivize reuse of existing buildings and maybe the protection of the look of a neighborhood. How is that done? Where is it being done effectively?
Well, I mean, to answer your question first, I want to go back to the landmarking and designation. You know, that's sort of, those are the principal tools of historic preservation, sort of creating historic districts or landmarking individual buildings. And I think that's fine. That's great. But really, that only gets at about 3 to 5% of a city in our analysis. You know, whereas something like 40, 50, 60, in some cases 70% of a city is constructed before 1945. So the landmarking and designation isn't going to get us to this broader set of buildings. So, yeah, how do we sort of come up with programs or policies or incentives that sort of support all those other buildings that aren't going to be landmarked? And I think the adaptive reuse ordinance in LA is a great example. I think the adaptive reuse program in Phoenix. Phoenix, a relatively new city like Charlotte, also a really fantastic program. You know, in Seattle, we have this overlay program that basically says you preserve the facade, you get a density bonus. I don't think that's worked out the way that people thought it might. I think it's really led to these sort of strange Frankenstein buildings that really look like new buildings but have an old shell around them. So I think that kind of impulse, trying to figure out how we can sort of accommodate density and at the same time hang on to especially old commercial fabric, I think is really going to be the solution moving forward. We need to kind of get past the yes, no, simple, designated and landmarked or not, you know, historic or not, start to think about things on the continuum. So come up with programs that can sort of get the right mix. You know, I started this conversation by saying there's something magical that happens where you have an old building next to a new building and those two things working in concert. I think we really need to see more of that, and I'm hopeful that we will.
Let me share some comments that have come in from listeners as we've been talking. Martin says, Asheville didn't have the money in the 1960s to tear down. Now look at the popularity of Asheville's old center city. Dee in Charlotte says, I really appreciate the comments on building community rather than just buildings. Dennis says, regarding parking, after 20 seasons, I'm in my third parking lot for Panthers games. I've had to move due to new construction twice and had to alter my walk to the stadium due to new construction. When the stadium was built, the Panthers offered parking only to players and staff, but they boasted that within blocks of the stadium there was ample game day parking. That actually created a windfall for business and parking lot owners. With all the construction eating up parking lots around the stadium, is the day coming that there will have to be a new stadium with parking or move the team to L.A.? Well, I think the answer to that question is self-evident. Yes, there will be a new stadium or the team will move because there'll be new ownership when Jerry Richardson dies. What about that? What about parking?
Well, we could also encourage him to pack his food and beverage cooler and hop on the transit and take it down for the game. There are all sorts of things. Multimodal systems for transportation are what, you know, older, smaller, you know, neighborhoods and cities are all about. So there, you know, there are different ways of looking at it, you know. But, you know, everybody loves to have their parking space. That's kind of the culture of Charlotte. It's interesting.
I want to get – you brought up these different transit options. We're building a streetcar in Charlotte. It's very controversial, Michael. You suggest that cities should steward the streetcar legacy. I'm sure you're talking about the neighborhoods that were created by – streetcars in the 1930s and 40s. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. So when we do these maps of cities, you know, these maps, something like 15 cities, including places like Charlotte and in Phoenix and Tucson, Arizona, but also Seattle, San Francisco, D.C., Chicago. And, you know, we sort of map out where the old buildings lie, where you have a mix of old and new buildings, where you have small structures, really fine-grained human-scale development. And the hot spots on these maps are consistently the areas just outside of downtown that had the streetcar connectivity, the sort of old streetcar downtowns. Because if you think about where sort of commercial structures came up, they'd be oriented around streetcar stops. And I think we certainly are seeing that. I mean, in Seattle, right near where the Green Lab offices are located, is sort of a base of old commercial structures. And that really, I think, is the sort of linchpin or the foundation of the whole community, of the neighborhood. So I think, you know, that's a very small portion of the buildings overall across the city. You know, I think something like 1% of the buildings in the city are actually this old streetcar sort of fabric. So I think we really need to be smart about not losing that. You know, I think these are going to continue to be the most attractive places for young people and people new to the city. And so we'd be making a huge mistake if we started, you know, tearing down and adding parking lots or tearing down the small stuff and building large new buildings. We'd be moving away from walkability and moving away from a local economy. I think people don't necessarily see that. And then so, just the parking thing, I just wanted to go back to that.
Okay.
You know, I just think smart city planning, I think in the 21st century, needs to at least imagine what the city looks like if cars are not such a common thing, if car ownership isn't such a predominant model. You know, I think in a lot of cities we're seeing that young people aren't even getting driver's licenses the way that they did even 10 or 20 years ago. So I think we need to start imagining, you know, it's great to have parking, you know, for the Panthers games. I know, I've been in that situation and don't like the walk. But I think we lack the imagination oftentimes when we think about what a downtown could look like, you know, if we started to build on those parking lots, and especially if we did it in a small scale way. You could build new great neighborhoods. You know, I think we oftentimes just get locked into, well, you're just going to be taking away the parking and making this a longer walk to the stadium. You're going to make my life more difficult. But we don't see the positive possibility.
Tom.
And I'd like to add to that, we've had over a half a century that has an obsession with parking. And I think that the architecture has tried to respond to that. I think there are certain building types that that basically taking long view, if they're designed in a way that parking and the importance of parking is so integral to the, say, the bones and structure that you can't at some point unhitch it when we move into this kind of post-autocentric era, which could be as soon as 10 or 20 years with all of the Google cars and the Apple cars and everything that are coming out soon.
They're still cars.
Driverless cars.
I'm going to go back to the streetcar thing for just a second, because the first leg of our very small streetcar line, we used to have streetcars that went to Dilworth and places like out to the plaza years ago. But now we have this new streetcar line that opens in the middle of July. It's only going to be a mile long, but it'll be longer later on. Are we likely to see, if that line goes in and is successful in attracting people to ride it, are we likely to see the same kind of development around that line that we saw in the 1930s and 40s when we had streetcars everywhere?
Well, I think we're going to see probably much more development than we had in the 30s and 40s, where we may have had one- and two-story shopfront buildings. They'll probably – I mean, the original plan for Elizabeth Avenue is much more significant mm-hmm. in density. And I think, going back to Seattle and Portland, there's this kind of – like the Pearl District in Portland, there's this kind of effect that, especially in the old economy, was unbelievably successful in terms of attracting, quality development, I think. And I think that's something that we can get excited about if it's done well. But there are lots of older, smaller buildings along the way that we really need to think about.
You're challenging fellow architects and urban designers, even landscape architects, to provide leadership. How difficult is that when the architects are working for developers and not doing this on their own?
Well, I think, I've been doing civic by design for more than a decade now, and that's been part of what we try to do is to really empower the design mm-hmm. and designers. And I think that we need to, pull together and really take a stand and push for it.
And you also advocate elevating the role of the building arts, but that's another hour.
That is, but it's something that's very important, I think.
Tom Lowe's an architect and director of Civic by Design. Michael Poe joined us by phone from Seattle, where he is senior research manager for the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Preservation